Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And I am Bob Hill. A little worried that 1 hour may not be enough to teach me how to cook anything.
I think it will be because it's absolutely simple.
I've heard that before.
Yeah. I think that we're here in my kitchen out here at the farm in Western Shelby County, and our annual food preservation show.
Bob eats and Janine cooks. Yeah, we got this down to a science, folks.
I think when it comes to men that aren't used to navigating the kitchen, and it's the cleanup part and the organizational part that's the problem, not necessarily the actual
what's cleanup.
Yeah, exactly. I'm pretty good at staying organized and like cleaning up as I go along.
Thank God.
I know other men are not necessarily that way.
Not this one.
But yeah, today on the show we're going to put up tomatoes and we're going to make some zucchini bread. Two things that are really easy to do that sort of solve the problem of having a bumper crop of tomatoes and not noticing that one zucchini, and then by the time you notice it, it's you know as big as a boat.
It's a baseball bat size.
Exactly.
Right?
So grating that up and turning it into zucchini bread. You can even freeze it and make zucchini bread later, but I usually make it now and then freeze the bread.
And then off to your right on my gleaming white counter here is a... looks like a small herd of, is it Roma?
A bowl full of Roma tomatoes.
Roma tomatoes.
Yes, but we will get to that in a little bit. First, I want to tell you a little bit about the other part of the show. Michael Paley is the chef down at Proof on Main at 21C.
Oh, yeah.
And I went down and visited with him a little bit to check out their rooftop garden. Really functional, great, and it serves the restaurant with herbs and other types of things. They also have a garden out at Woodland Farm that they, you know, grow and serve stuff in the restaurant.
And
so.
They don't serve roast penguin, I hope.
No, they don't.
Okay, I wondered about
but,
that.
But, hey, that may be something you might want to consider. They do. So that's coming up in the second part of the show here today on Homegrown. So it's definitely a food-oriented, fresh from the garden, a good summertime topic, to be sure. What's going on in your garden, Bob?
Grasses. I love this time of year because my grasses are bearing seed pods and upright and doing all sorts of wonderful things.
And all the rain, they're robust.
Oh, my gosh.
And
I got a couple annuals I like. One of them's called fiber optic grass, which is really cool, bright green, and got little beady tips on it. It looks like fiber optics, and it's just a neat grass to have. And, of course, the purple fountain grass, not hardy here, but this time of the year is a huge statement, big purple, bright grass. And my favorite grass is the Carl Forrester, the upright, beautiful grass, nice background, 5 or 6 feet tall. Beautiful, looks like hay, a beautiful seed head on it, and... anyway, you plant grasses in the spring hoping you get this fall effect, and by golly, we're getting it.
You're getting it, yeah, and it is a good year for them.
What's happening out here in the
Wishy Two things State? I wanted to tell you about. One is, look, okay, sorry everybody that's listening because you can't look, but maybe we'll take a picture of it. Look at this. Can you find the little inchworm in that little bowl?
It looks like a quarter inchworm, actually. It would be an inchworm, but he's inching along. It looks like there are flower seeds or some
petals. All over him.
On his or her body
as
a perfect camouflage from anything that might want to eat a quarter inchworm.
Isn't that fabulous?
It is. It's really cool.
It's she's beautiful. She's basically covered in little pieces of petal. And I think I had cut some Rudbeckia and I saw this on the counter and I, you know, looked and I'm like, hey, wait a minute. So I put her in a little dish and I give her a fresh flower petal every day. You know, the kind of flower she likes, so she eats that. And I think she's tearing them off and putting them on her back. I can't really tell if that's like her own disguise naturally or if she's actually, you know, putting them on. But it's fascinating. It kind of, it's a real life experience of what Baron Heinrich was, you know, telling us about just, you know, a month or so ago, Summer World, about how insects, caterpillars can mimic that which they eat because then it makes them not detectable by some sort of predator.
It's the only pet inchworm, I think, and probably in North America. And you're right, it looks just looks like part of the flower.
It's beautiful.
And you can never tell except when it stretches out to do its little moving along thing.
Yeah.
It could probably cover a yard in 3 or 4 years.
It's just amazing what we don't notice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You'd never notice this. Yeah. As a critter at all.
Yeah, so I'm going to hang on to her, keep feeding her, and see what happens.
Well, if it gets to be 12 feet long.
Yeah. Okay, and one quick story. Talking about feeding, we have a predatory hawk around here, apparently.
Uh-oh.
And I thwarted a swoop-down effort by this hawk to grab one of my chickens. Uh-oh. And I don't really know. There's, you know, they've gotten big enough now where I'm not entirely sure that this hawk could really pick up.
Yeah, a chicken?
A really, you know what I mean? Because but these are pretty big chickens. These aren't bannies or anything like that.
But you can't blame the hawk for trying.
That's no, you can't. But I was like, and then the hawk, you know, flew up. But it was funny because they knew the hawk was there, so they are hiding under the shrubs, right?
The wishy chicken protector is in full force.
And I suspect that something's up just from the way that their sounds are. Yeah. And I walk back there, and me walking back there, I think, made this one barred rock come out from underneath the shrub toward me. And as soon as she did, that's when the hawk swooped down.
But the hawks being hawks aren't going to go away.
No, they aren't. And yeah. I think hawks live in the front field there, okay, too. So, you know, it's living in the country and having animals, and it is what it is.
I hope your chickens appreciate you.
They, and I'm proud of them, too, that they were all mostly hiding underneath the shrub at the time. Yeah. So.
Well, this is fun. We got to visit them earlier today, and they're out there.
They're out there.
She's not making this up, folks.
They're cute.
She pets them. She talks to them. They do circus tricks.
That's right.
They're going to go to kindergarten in a couple
of
years.
If you have food on you, they run to you and flap their wings.
Muck, 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 sort of like
you, Bob.
That's right.
All right. So, yeah, that's what's going on out here, among other things. But I think there's other things going on.
There is indeed another wonderful event at UDEL, August 29th from 1 to 4 p.m. If you like hummingbirds, and who doesn't, they're going to have an expert out there to tell you how to take pictures of hummingbirds. They'll have experts out there who will catch, band, and release hummingbirds. We had a show
probably
on that.
Probably Brainerd will be out there.
Yeah, we had a show on that a while back. It's just really fun to see. Hummingbirds are wonderful creatures. They have children's activities out there, too. So, again, it's August 29th from 1 to 4 p.m. at UDEL. More information on our website.
All right. So, going on in the kitchen here, are you ready to start this?
I'm all ears, eyes, nose, and larynx.
All right. I'm going to need you to follow me around with a microphone, if you can do that, because I can't stand here in one spot.
I'm coachable.
Okay. Pot's getting ready to boil. I've got this bowl full of Roma tomatoes. And the thing about Roma tomatoes, Bob, they are what are called determinate. So they grow to a certain point. They fruit. And most of the fruit comes ripe all at the same time. So it's a great tomato. I mean, texture-wise, it's a great tomato for canning, but it's great because then you've got a whole bunch mostly at the same time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're about the size of great big red chicken eggs, as far as I can tell. So this isn't your chicken's work, is it?
No, it's not. and here's the thing that you have to do with canning tomatoes. I do not, like, take the seeds out because I don't want my tomato. I want chunkier canned tomatoes. But the boiling water, which is boiling now, we're going to take these over here and we're going to drop tomatoes in.
Don't use the word drop and bowl with me at the same time, please.
We're going to put some in and we're going to scald them. They'll be in there for about a minute and then we'll scoop them out, put them in a bowl, and then we'll put the next round in there.
And the tomatoes are kind of bobbling around in the scalding water. It's kind of cool.
And the scalding, you'll see, it'll start to shrivel the skin up a little bit, and then we'll take them out, and the skin just falls right off. You just peel it right off. So it's a great way to kind of maintain that chunkier, and the whole tomato, to get the skin off. So once they've scalded, we'll peel all the skin off. It'll take a couple seconds, and then we'll dump everything back into the pot, and we'll cook it for about 5 minutes. And then literally, we put it into canning jars, and then we're ready to give it a hot water bath. Do you see how simple it is?
What's this "we" part? No, you said, okay. We're going to do this.
You're going to help me a little bit. Here, let me show you this great book. This is the Ball Blue Book. It originally cost 10 cents. It was published in Muncie, Indiana, because, of course, that's where the Ball Brothers Company was. It was published in 1947. Things have changed in terms of, like, USDA recommendations, that sort of thing. But when I go and talk to groups, I'll tell them about, you know, stuff that I'm canning, and ladies will be like, "Oh, honey, you don't need to do that," you know. So I'm starting to get a little more bold about trusting the older methods in terms of canning. But here's our basic from the Ball 1947 Blue Book. Tomatoes, regular pack. Wash firm, fresh, sound, ripe tomatoes. Scald a few at a time and drain. Cut out all core and all hard or green spots. Skin. Pack solidly into hot ball jars. Add 1 teaspoon salt to each quart. Add no liquid. Process 45 minutes in a hot water bath. Or you can boil prepared tomatoes 5 minutes, pour into hot jars, and process 20 minutes in a hot water bath.
Now, do you have only approved ball jars here? We're using some other counterfeit types.
I have ball and mason and, you know, basically a whole collection of things that have been around forever. But we need to take these out because they've scalded sufficiently.
Okay, we're about to can in a fruit jar, which is a saying I've always wondered about. But Miss Wishy's reaching up to get some device in which to put the tomatoes.
That would be a colander.
To get a colander. And she's walking over to the sink, and something about we are going to do something about taking the skins off these poor tomatoes. Is this legal?
We're going to have to let them cool a little bit first, but we still have a couple more rounds of tomatoes to go, because if you touch those, you're going to burn your fingertips. Although your fingertips are pretty worn down from all that gardening work, you may not feel anything.
Okay, she's dolloping the Roma tomatoes out of the hot water into this colander thing. It's about the same color as the tomatoes. It's kind of a nice color combination here. It's red on red.
Okay, and we'll put the rest of them in here.
Okay, we're going to go back and scald some more Roma tomatoes. I wonder if the Roma Protective Society is going to come out here at some point and tell you to stop this stuff.
I doubt it. They'd be happy that they're being put to good use. Otherwise, they just rot and spoil, right?
Now, generally, when this is all done, how long will these tomatoes last in your ball jars?
They should last, you know, the standard is they last up to a year for sure. And honestly, they'll last longer than that as long as I do it right. And the thing is that once you open a jar, if something's not right, you're going to know that immediately. And I've had one failure, and somehow the top actually eroded, so there were holes in top of the pickle cap, you know, so clearly I'm not going to eat those pickles. But if it's, you know, bad, you're going to open it and you're going to smell it, or it's going to go poof, or, you know, there's going to be some sort of, you know, stinky gas that's emitted. So you really don't have to worry too much about, you know, making yourself sick, as long as you have some common sense.
Okay, Miss Wishy, the tomatoes have cooled in this colander thing, and now
they're still hot. I want everybody to know, so they're still hot. But they're not so hot where they're going to burn the, you know what, out of my hands. But see how easy that comes off? Look at that.
Well, look at that. It comes off in one big package.
Right. So
I thought you had to peel it like an apple.
No, look. You just squeeze it and boink, comes off.
Boink.
So literally, what am I doing? I'm dropping
She's slicing the top off, grabbing the top of the tomato, and just pulling it like a balloon off the bottom of the tomato.
So what we're going to do, what I did last time processing the tomatoes, I actually boiled them for a couple of minutes, so it's more of a tomato saucy kind of thing that's canned. And these we're going to stick in there whole. So we're not going to cook these anymore, but they're still hot. So we're going to go ahead and can, you know, what you would consider whole tomatoes, but being skinned.
Okay, so when it comes to eating these things, will they still be whole a year from now, or will they disintegrate a bit in the ball jar?
They should still look exactly like this. Absolutely. And so you use these, like I would use that other sauce that I made in chili. You can use these in chili too, if you like chunkier sort of tomatoes. You can make pasta sauces. You can just eat them warmed up fresh. You could eat them cold if you like tomatoes and cottage cheese, you know.
Wow.
Basically like what you would get at the store in a can.
Say what you want about Jeanine Wishy, folks. The girl can really take the lid off of Roma tomatoes. You know, some vague and indeterminate part of me is beginning to believe I actually could do this if I had to do it in a pinch.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. It's think about how people used to feed themselves, right? We can have gardens this time of the year, but what about all those other times of the year, you know? So you've got to put the food up somehow. And when you didn't get it, when it wasn't so easy where you could just go to Kroger and get whatever you wanted, this is the way people did it. And I've been looking into other ways of preserving food that are old-fashioned, you know, without fancy canning processes. And like there's, you know, using salt and oil and lacto fermentation. It's all really fascinating. I mean, think about country ham.
I'd rather eat it, but go ahead. Yeah. Fine.
You know, preserving meat using salt.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Now, you are holding a very sharp knife in your right hand. I haven't mentioned that, so maybe I'll back up a little bit and lean out with the microphone.
Okay. We're about ready to finish up here, Bob. Other thing we're going to need is some caning salt. And the difference between caning salt and just regular table salt is that there's absolutely nothing in caning salt other than just plain old salt. So you don't, it's not like iodized and all that stuff. So that's good to use. What we're going to do is, maybe I'll get you to do this while I'm finishing up. Open the dishwasher and we can get those jars out and we'll start the
dishwasher.
Process.
Bob's bending over to open the dishwasher. He hasn't succeeded
he
yet.
Yeah, pull it up.
Oh, there it's got a door that comes down.
Now roll the basket out.
Look at this. There, folks, there are knives and forks and spoons and plates in the dishwasher. I had no idea.
And jars.
This is a curd jar. This is a curd jar. There better be a ball one in here. We're going to throw away that.
Oh, there's a mason.
Throw away that book. Oh, this has got a Liberty Bell on it. Oh, it's a mason jar. Sorry, ball. No jar.
Okay, now what we're going to do, we've got this little funnel thing, right?
A funnel thing, yes. Very precise.
We're going to add our tomatoes that are still whole to our jar.
Thing, yep.
Yeah.
They're kind of like little animals going down a hole here.
Mm-hmm.
They slide right in.
Okay, and then we top it off with a teaspoon of salt.
Ooh, it's kind of salt's kind of melting into the tomatoes.
Fill the next one.
The next curd jar coming up.
We may only get two jars out of this. Teaspoon of salt.
And last but not least, the mason jar.
All right. That one's got a little more juice in it. That's perfectly all right.
If you don't get it filled all the way to the top, is that a crime? Can you have to you have to get more tomatoes?
You know what? You really should fill them all the way to the top, and that's a great question because this last one didn't quite go to the top. I'm going to go ahead and process it, but what I'll do is I'll make sure that this is one that I will consume earlier on, or in some instances I end up putting these jars, the one that's not so full, eat them straight away or put them in the refrigerator, you know?
Well, let's talk lids. You've had these in hot water.
Yep.
You're putting them on top.
Hey, look what it says on top. The lids are ball, at least.
It's a ball lid on a curd jar.
There we go. Is that
just a great country or what?
Is that illegal or not? All right, and then screw the lids on tight. And then we're going to take them back to the old stove that was in my parents' original house. And we're going to drop them in the fabulous big kettle that you and Janet bought me not too long ago. And we're going to let them process for 45 minutes in a hot water bath. And that'll kill, you know, any additional, like, bacteria and that sort of thing. That's basically the process. The thing about tomatoes, they already are pretty acidic. And that's why you can can tomatoes so easily, because they have that acid in there already. Like, we wouldn't be able to do that with green beans. We'd have to, you know, pickle them or do something else or use a pressure cooker. So that's the cool thing about tomatoes. They're so extremely easy. So, okay, that's done. How long did that take us?
Well, about 2 hours.
Not very long, no. Now you want to make some zucchini bread?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You got some baseball bat-sized zucchinis here, 7-iron, whatever you prefer. We're heading across the kitchen, and Miss Wishy has some sliced up zucchinis. It looks like actually like half of a fish.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in a beautiful blue. Was this one of these colander things, too?
Mm-hmm.
You got colander things in different colors.
Yeah, I use them a lot. And I like color.
Okay, we got the zucchini sliced up into nice pieces, about maybe 6-8 inches long, mm-hmm. 1 inch wide. What's going to happen next?
Well, I slice them that way so that we can feed them into the top of the food processor, the Cuisinart. And shredding mechanism on there. And I spread the zucchini this way. And you can actually just use a plain old grater, you know, a hand grate. And that's, you know, just as easy. But since I'm doing a lot here, I'm going to go ahead and use the Cuisinart.
So what did Grandma do before this electric thing?
She used the hand grater. And I was actually going to make you do that, but then I was afraid you might, like, grade your knuckles or something like that.
You're
and that
right.
would be in our zucchini bread, and that would be disgusting.
Blood on the microphone exactly. Just wouldn't work anymore.
That's right. All right, the zucchini bread recipe, and we can put this on the website as well, but it's one that my sister and her friend Dee Dee always make. It's her favorite. Basically, you need 2 loaf pans. You want to grease your loaf pans, you know, just with some cooking spray is fine. And then you sprinkle some flour on the pan, too, and it sticks to that oil, so that way your bread's not going to stick. Preheat the oven to 350, And then we've got two bowls here, Bob. One bowl, we're going to mix 3 eggs, 2 cups of sugar, and 1 cup of vegetable oil.
I watched Julia Child do this.
Oh, yeah? I met Julia Child once. Did I ever tell you about that?
No.
It was one of those pivotal moments in your life history.
Did she talk like this?
She was so nice. I could not believe how gracious she was. It was so very exciting meeting her. So, yes, I'm sure she cracks eggs better than I do any day. So, one bowl, we've got our wet mixture, which is the eggs, sugar, and vegetable oil. Mix that up a little bit. Okay, now, Bob, we've got our dry part, which is 3 cups of flour, and then we need 1 teaspoon of baking soda and 1 teaspoon of salt, 1 tablespoon of cinnamon, and 1/2 teaspoon of baking powder.
All right, Miss Wishy, the moment of truth here.
Okay, so we've got our dry ingredients now mixed, our wet in another bowl, and our zucchini is shredded. Whoops. Zucchini is shredded, and we're going to measure out 2 cups. That's Buck. We're going to measure out 2 cups of this. Look how pretty that is, the shredded zucchini.
Does Buck like zucchini bread?
Yeah. I think he would be quite delighted to eat zucchini bread. So 2 cups of shredded zucchini, and we're going to add this to our dry mixture.
I got to say, going in, this is not nearly as attractive as tomatoes.
No.
This is a real mess of stuff here. And then, I think I like zucchini bread, but boy, getting there is a little bit of a mental problem.
Yeah, for you, yeah, I would think. Okay, I got 1/2 cup of chopped nuts into the dry mixture. And now what we're going to do is we're going to spoon this wet mixture into our dry. Eggs and butter and oil. And then we're going to mix it. And then we'll pour it into our loaf pans. And we've, you know, preheated the oven to 350. And we will bake this bread. I have a convection oven, so it usually takes about 50 minutes. So anywhere between 50 minutes and 60 minutes.
Well, at this point in time, it's no more pretty than it was when you started, I'll tell you that.
It's beautiful, those long, nice pieces of zucchini. Oh, but you're right. It's kind of goopy. It's the oil, I think, that makes it kind of vomity looking.
Well, it looks like 2-week-old spaghetti,
that's
actually.
What you were thinking. I'll send you some bread home, though. I have some in the freezer.
Okay.
But the point is really to be able to use some of the stuff that comes out of the garden. And, you know, if something's past peak, this zucchini is fabulous making this bread. Once this bread's baked and once it cools off, you can slip it in little bags or wrap it in foil, and you can freeze it. It freezes beautifully, Bob. You know, it's just a good way to use food, process food for later use. So we'll go ahead and pour, you know, half in one loaf pan and the other half in the second loaf pan.
Are these ball loaf pans?
They are not ball loaf pans. Thank goodness I had ball lids. I would have been in big trouble. And then we'll just stick it in the oven and put the timer on, and we'll have bread in about an hour.
Okay, Miss Wishy, I noticed there's been no yeast added to this product. Does it rise much in these pans? It looks like about half full.
Right. See, this is the thing. This is why this is a great bread, too. For inexperienced, you know, bread's hard to make when you're using yeast. And these are, you know, non-rising breads. They're more cake breads. So they will rise a little bit more than what you see in here, but not by much. So it's a denser sort of bread, and it's way easier to make, obviously, than if you were trying to use yeast. Because Andy makes really good baguette, but mine usually are like Louisville Sluggers.
And what is zucchini bread best served with?
I like it slightly toasted with a little butter on it. It's sort of decadent that way.
How about peanut butter?
You could put peanut butter on it for sure. You could put anything on it, really.
I'm liking it better all the time.
And if it's a good moist batch, it really doesn't need anything on it at all. But if you toast it again, it sort of brings the flavor out.
And how zucchini-ish is it when you're eating it?
You wouldn't know it was in there at all. And that's a great way to try to get zucchini into your little kids. Georgie loves zucchini, but all the kids I've ever known love zucchini bread. So you just call it something different, and they eat zucchini.
But that's horribly unfair to the zucchini.
Why? That it doesn't get the credit it deserves?
It doesn't taste like zucchini.
I know, I believe it. But otherwise, that large zucchini that looked like a small submarine that we shredded up okay. probably would have been fed to the chickens.
All right, kids, use them for baseball bats and forget this bread thing.
Okay. See, Bob, if you think that you can do this, then anybody can do this.
But seriously, Miss Wishy, people aren't cooking as much anymore, and they should be.
They really should be. And Michael Pollan recently has been talking about how people watch an awful lot of cooking shows, but they don't cook. And, you know, we're told that we don't have the time to do it, yet we're sitting and watching television. And it's a good way to spend your time, you know, just organize a little bit. And we should cook more. It brings us together around the table. Nutrition-wise, it's so much better. I just enjoy it so much. It's super easy. And once you get certain things down pat, cooking from scratch is not this amazingly difficult thing or super time consuming either, if you kind of get into the groove of it.
I can make a good ice cube. Is that a good start?
My freezer makes good ice cubes, so you may be out of a job.
Well, thanks for the lesson, Miss Wishy. I appreciate it. And don't give up on me.
I won't. And I'll you know, I always share the end result with you anyway, so we'll keep you fed.
And for our listeners, we have a couple photos of this experience on the website, as well as the recipes.
Yes, and coming up, I visit with Chef Michael Paley, who is the head chef there at Proof on Main, which, of course, is in 21C Hotel downtown. They've got a great rooftop garden that they produce stuff for their own kitchen. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? That's coming up. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Well, I finally made it to Proof on Main, part of 21C, a hotel that was built back in, early or mid-2000s?
Yeah, it was, I believe, a 3 to 4 year project that the hotel finally opened in March 15th, 2006.
Okay. So, and the restaurant did as well. And 21C, of course, is Laura Lee Brown and Steve Wilson's hotel, sort of known, I think more than anything else, the culture here is tangible. And I think part of what Michael Paley, Chef Paley, who's with me today, is trying to do with Proof on Main, their restaurant, is also make it a little more tangible, perhaps. And we're here because he just toured the rooftop garden to show me what kind of stuff they're growing up there. Also out at Laura Lee and Steve's farm, Woodland Farm, they're growing stuff there for the restaurant. And I've had an interesting conversation about the challenges and the experiences using that in the restaurant. So thanks for taking us on a tour, Chef Paley, and hosting us here.
My pleasure.
A little bit about your background. You've been here from the beginning, since 2006. A hardcore culinary experience, or just sort of happen upon being able to cook well?
It's just kind of something that I've always, even as a kid, I used to watch Great Chefs, that old show. I don't know what drew me to it just by watching that. I think I just liked the sounds of the kitchen, the stainless steel. It was clean, you know, the organization of it. And, you know, I definitely like good food. And interpreting dishes in my own way, not necessarily always following recipes or following any kind of preformed structure from how to make a dish or how to put a menu together and put a menu out on a nightly basis too. So I find cooking is rewarding as tasting good. And, you know, one thing I tell my cooks is that, of course, the most important thing is consistency. And, you know, if the cook, their only responsibility is to make a pork chop every night, they have the opportunity to wow someone 30 times a night. And they have that kind of instant gratification when they look at their food and they say, okay, this one was better than the last one. Or, you know, I'm really nailing this today. And that's kind of what draws me to it, as well as what we've been talking about today. Just our passion here for local produce and incorporating local flair and local farmers, and which is something that I've really come into really enjoying and really knowing a lot about here. And it's, we still have a lot to learn.
So let's talk a little bit about the rooftop garden and the ideas behind it when you first started and what you have learned since then. Because it's what, the second year or third year?
Second year. We definitely, I wanted to start it as just a project for me and the cooks, just have some bourbon barrels or pots with herbs in them to grow that we could garnish dishes with and, you know, say this is ours. And but it definitely grew into something a little bit bigger than that. I think the first year maybe we tried to do too much. And this year we were trying to do less items but more of them quantity-wise. We're actually producing more with less, and last year we produced less with more. So, and but you know, first year, obviously in a new space, and it's hot up there, and not knowing how things would do, not being in the grounds and being in pots of different depths, and it's been a growing experience. And this year, adding that whole element of our woodland farm, which we'll talk about after this, but so it's been fun, and you know, I'm looking forward to next year. Getting the seed catalogs out and seeing what else we want to do or keep it the same. I mean, to me, the roof garden is more of a utility for us because I just, it's important that it gets used in the real sense where it's not landscape architecture. It's something for the kitchen to use to make food, to even financially, why buy products when we can grow them? Seeds are cheaper and you have more pride in stuff that you use your own hands to grow. So
tell us a little bit about the logistics of working on a rooftop garden. You had alluded to the fact that it's very hot up there. I mean, even in this mild summer that we're having this year, but it's very hot up there, water, exposure, that sort of thing. How have you addressed those issues?
Well, first of all, when I also said that, you know, they're not growing on the ground, the way the pots are set up is that they're lined with popcorn styrofoam and layered with dirt. So we definitely couldn't grow things that rooted too deep. So that's why, you know, we do bunch baby carrots up there. We pull them. We don't let them go too deep. And we found anything that does isn't really working out. So some things just need to be grown in the ground. And that's why last year we did a variety of heirloom tomatoes. This year we're kind of sticking with Sun Gold or cherry grape-sized tomatoes because, I feel like the flavor-wise you get less. It's not as much impact as a larger heirloom where you really taste the soil. I mean, they're great, sweet tomatoes, but I think they definitely are growing better up there.
So heat's a factor. Water's a factor, too.
And, you know, we're kind of busy, and we don't have a big staff, so we installed irrigation, so we could definitely make sure it was getting watered every day, especially when we get into the end of July and August, because we first year having issues, make sure everything was watered evenly, and it's on a roof, so we do have issues with wind sometimes. That's kind of why things are placed. A lot of the stuff is placed where it is to block it from direct wind. And, of course, all the tomato plants are luckily on that railing where they're tied up with the pantyhose so they don't fall and break and everything like that. So
let's talk about the farm, Woodland Farm. You also have space available to you out there. Pretty much that garden is at your disposal. They're strictly growing stuff for Proof on Main.
Yeah, we have about 8 40-foot by 20-foot beds out there. We grew everything from flowers to decorate the dining room to right now we're getting great harvests slow, but they're coming, but great harvests on heirloom tomatoes, and we're starting to get beans now and potatoes and eggplants and peppers. So when we set out to decide in November what seeds to buy, I definitely took Stephanie Tittle's advice because she knew the land and a lot of this is experimental for her too. So what's going to grow and how to grow it in a way, how to plant each bed in a way where we could get constant harvest out of it instead of just one shot. So, you know, if we have a 40-foot bed, we broke it up into thirds and planted that way. So we could, by the time we were done harvesting the last third, the first third was ready to do again. So that's worked out pretty well. Like we talked about, you know, we don't just want an ornamental garden. Well, I don't want an ornamental farm either. Like, obviously, we can't grow enough Swiss chard to use on the menu for 2 weeks. It's just something that when you cook it, it volumes down a lot. So we do a couple of varieties, chard and collard greens, and maybe switch in and out. So
how does this all translate? I mean, because ultimately you're the chef here. So how does this translate into a menu at proof when you have, you anticipate having the next couple of months as being a fabulous production and all these new things. So, you know, what's a week like for you, knowing what's going to be brought in, taking a look at what's brought in from the farm or harvested from the roof, and then devising a menu that really highlights it?
Well, we definitely set the menu up where it can change. I know some of the key ingredients we're growing, and definitely keeping the customer in mind. I mean, everyone loves heirloom tomatoes and everybody loves corn, so we know we're going to have these things. And sometimes those items will stay as the same dish. To me, heirloom tomatoes, they need to be served with sea salt and basil, and it'll always be some kind of variation on that. We also grew some great stewing tomatoes just to make sauce, and we're doing a great papa pomodoro, so bread and tomato soup right now. So
you showed me some interesting cucumbers, some interesting eggplant as well. Talk about the, you know, choosing. You said you talked to Stephanie, and Stephanie Tittle is actually the gardener out at Woodland Farm. But you and Stephanie sort of discuss and try to figure out what you like this year. Deduction, really. Grow a couple of varieties of one thing, pick your favorite out of those, grow more of that next year. You know, what's the reasoning behind picking some of these things?
I mean, those two plants, for example, were potatoes and garlic. That needs space and you need room. And if you really want to do production for a restaurant menu, you need to devote space to it. So garlic and potatoes are new things for us to grow. So this year we did three varieties of each, and just we'll decide which ones we like the best. So next year we know what to plant in one large batch, so I can get a large return off of it. The eggplants right now, we have a couple great varieties, but you can definitely work with mixing those, and you can with potatoes as well. But garlic, you definitely, for a restaurant kitchen, we want something that's plump and easy to peel. And when you have the clove, you don't want to have too many small cloves as far as the whole one. So the variety we chose there was nice, easily worked through, because everything has to be kept in mind. I mean, it's not okay, we got all these great ingredients, we bought these great seeds and grow it in a great setting. I mean, it's also a business, and we have payroll and labor, and want to make sure that we're conscious of not overspending or overstretching ourselves.
So in terms of non-productive times of the year here in Louisville, do you just sort of resort to the old-fashioned way of acquiring your product for the restaurant?
Well, I want to, because this is the third year that we've really tried to do this. This one's been so much fun, and it's going to be the next month. I think that'll be the next task, is how can we keep up this momentum in the winter, which is not going to be easy. But, I mean, you also have, the focus can switch more to proteins, and not that there's no vegetables anymore, but there's certain things that in the coming year, I mean, there's roots, and do we want to put up greenhouses? I mean, that's something we'll consider down the line, but we'll focus things where we can whenever possible, and that'll be the new challenge.
So there's also part of the menu, the appetizer part, is, highlighted local produce, but not all the produce necessarily comes from, or all the product necessarily comes from the roof or from Woodland Farms. Are there other, do you buy directly from farmers, or are you going through some of the other wholesalers that buy from farmers that are in Louisville?
Both. I have three or four farmers that will drive up with stuff. And the cool thing is that in the first year that didn't happen, and like every year they kind of just, now they're knowing without me reaching out or meeting them at a farmer's market or something like that, they kind of just come. And, I have a guy that grows great peaches, he brings them in, a lady that does great greens and various things, Carol Friedman. We also get our eggs from Waterworks Farms, and they also do provide us with corn and beans too. So, as far as suppliers go, we have Grasshoppers, the distributors here. Their program is great this year, as well as Creation Gardens. Their local Kentucky Proud program is great this year.
So are you looking for other contacts, the folks that are growing things? And I mean, that's part of the challenge as well. You got to know who you can rely on in terms of delivering certain products.
Well, the fun part is that you'll find the person that specializes in one thing. Like Sandy, who we get asparagus from for like a week, and it's only a week, but it's great asparagus. And the window on asparagus is short. And so I know every year that Sandy's going to have asparagus for us. And that might be the only time that we see her that year. But that's something to look forward to every year.
So far, what's been your favorite summer dish here at Proof this year with your Woodland Farmer rooftop bounty?
I'd say right now we have the four or five local produce items, which are salads that incorporate, I'd say, 95% to 98% local ingredients, and usually in a raw, you know, unaltered stage where they're just kind of sliced and put on the plate, hinted with some salt, which everything needs a little bit of that. And we have a great peach salad right now, and of course our heirlooms with some great cucumbers and nice creamy mozzarella. So, and the basil that I've already talked about. So obviously I like that one, and I made it at home last night. So that's got to be my favorite one. I look forward to the heirlooms every summer, like having that first tomato and mayo sandwich on white bread with a really good heirloom. You know, that's I really look forward to that. So
sometimes those pure flavors are the best flavors, huh? Mm-hmm.
And what we do on our cold station, and I drive the cooks crazy, but they have a basket on the cutting board with, it's full of tomatoes and cucumbers and peaches, and they get sliced to order. I mean, that's the best way to do it. You have ripe ingredients here. You can't, when you're doing 100 covers in a night, you want to be set up where, okay, I'm slicing all my heirlooms for my salad, but we have an extra person working there to make sure that happens. So when the salad comes in, he slices the peaches, he slices the tomatoes, they go in the bowl, they get tossed, they go out. So that's as fresh as we can do it. And it only works with really great fresh ingredients. So
there's more to it than you realize, people. What do you think? It sounds like you do have pretty good organizational skills or figuring it out. Well, good luck to you. I look forward to seeing how the rooftop garden progresses and the type of stuff that you get from the farm in the future. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Michael Paley is the head chef here at Proof on Main, which is, of course, part of 21C Hotel down here on Main Street in downtown Louisville. For more information on the stuff that we've talked about on Proof's menu this summer, please visit our website at wfpl.org. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill, who's absolutely stuffed.
Stuffed, and we're still at the farm.
And proud of it.
Back at the farm.
I know. But you served us lunch.
Yes.
And the listeners have served us two questions, by the way.
They have. Shall we begin then?
I'll give you the first one.
Okay.
From Phyllis. I have a very mature pink dogwood that I'm very worried I will lose. She lives on a small lot in Louisville. The dogwood's in a patio area beneath a 52-foot ash tree. So it's an understory tree. Here's the problem. About 4 years ago, she noticed that the dogwood began showing autumn colors. She was told that was due to stress due to lack of water. However, this year, that's not a problem. And when I moved in 15 years ago, it had an open space in its trunk, which is almost completely healed. What should I do? I want to save my tree.
Honestly, the whole early fall color is a sign of stress.
Right.
But as we know, stress comes in many forms, does it not? Just like with people, same thing with the trees. You know, too much water, not enough water. The fact that she's mentioned that there is a healed scar on the trunk could predispose this particular tree to some stress when there is, I mean, honestly, too much rain stresses out the root system, and you know, if it's compacted soil or that sort of thing, just as much as not enough rain, because that oxygen isn't there to kind of help along the rest of the processes of the root function. So the fact that the scar's there too, Bob, the cambium layer in that area could be damaged to a certain degree, so the transfer of the tree. Overall, it's healthy, but there could just be a little stress. So this particular tree is going to, you know, more often than not, probably show early fall color. Not entirely unusual.
And I read somewhere, true or not, I'm not even sure, that pink dogwoods or the bright flowered dogwoods are more susceptible to problems than than the white ones.
That may or may not be true. Well, no, but it makes sense. You know, it does. Because, like, if you think about like certain white cultivars of species that are typically yellow or pink, they're usually not as robust.
Exactly.
You know, so I think you may be onto something there too.
Well, I hope so.
So essentially, the best thing that we can do if we feel like a plant is stressed is try to create the best environment for it, right? So, you know, water we don't need to worry about this year, but other years we may. Make sure that the mulch isn't piled up around the base of the trunk. Make sure it's not over mulched. Make sure, you know, the soil's not compacted, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, for now, I wouldn't worry about it too much if all else looks pretty good. I mean, I've got some dogwoods that actually, because of new growth that has come on because of all the rain, the new foliage sort of has a bronzier sort of some of the Coosa dogwoods.
Yeah, so this year it doesn't count.
Just enjoy how great it's been, right? All right, here's one from Beth. Bob and Janine, I hope you can help me. Every summer I smell the most wonderful plant that smells faintly of cinnamon. I smell it mostly in the evenings when the air is humid. I live in Goshen and smell it in the neighborhood, and I also smell it at Creasy Mahan Nature Preserve. I bought some purple petunias this year that have a smell that's similar, but it isn't quite right, and it's not the right plant. Additionally, if I smell it at the nature preserve, it wouldn't be something like a petunia. Not necessarily, because they could have petunias out there too, but she's wondering if we have any idea if this is a small plant or a tree. Thanks for your time.
My idea, right or wrong again, would be the clethra, which is a beautiful late summer, early
summer
fall plant.
Sure.
You know, like pink chimes, has this wonderful cinnamony, clove-like odor to it. It's a very noticeable shrub. I'm surprised she hasn't been able to see it.
Because don't they call it the spice bush?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't miss seeing them. It's just white candles or pink candles. Beautiful plant. So that's my best guess. What do you think?
And it's a native plant as well. So it would not be unusual for it to be sort of out in the area in Goshen or out at the Creasy Mahan. I think that sounds like a good guess. But, you know, a lot of plants, especially, she says, you know, in the evening and when it's humid, a lot of scents really do come out when it cools down, the sun goes down, and especially if the air is humid. And there's a lot of spicy smells out there if you take time to smell them.
And if you don't have one, Beth, go buy one.
Yeah. But, yeah, so, yeah, go check out a clethra and see if that's the scent that you so desire. All right. So, yeah, if you've got questions, how can people get a hold of us, Bob?
If you have difficult questions for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Or call us at 814-8246.
Bob, it's Plant Story Day. What do you have?
I was walking in your gravel path earlier in the show, and I noticed three or four plants growing up in the gravel. They bloom this time of year. What was it?
Cleome.
You got it.
Yeah. We allow errant things growing here and there from every year. It's a tradition.
Sure it is.
If they don't come up in the path, something's wrong.
It's a great plant, the Cleome. It's called the spider plant, the Rocky Mountain bee plant, the yellow bee plant, and grandfather's whiskers. I didn't know that one.
I haven't heard that one. That's good.
And as you said, it's an annual late summer bloomer. It reseeds like crazy everywhere. Maybe too prolific for some, but it's drought tolerant. Obviously, it's growing in gravel. Takes full sun. The name's derived from the Greek word kleos, meaning glory.
Huh.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
It was a name given to by, and I'm sure you know this, the Greek philosopher Theophrastus.
Of course.
To a plant that resembled mustard. It's also called a spider plant because of the long, spindly daddy long legs on it. It's cool. As a method of self-protection, this is interesting also, it's got the sticky sap on it.
It's got thorny things on it,
It's got tiny thorns and an odor that ranks somewhere between unpleasant and yuck. So it's got some downsides to it. But, you know, there's different cultivars, and you can cut it back to make it more bushy. And there's more colors than people realize. There's one called Linda Armstrong. It's a compact pink thornless. Cherry Queen, pink purple. Sparkler White, and I have that. It's a pure white one. It's really nice.
That's really pretty.
Violet Queen, purple. And the new one, I didn't know about this. The Purdue Extension folks raved about it. Senorita Rosalita. Have you heard of that one? It's lavender pink, shorter, more compact, longer bloomer, has no thorns, does not reseed. Senorita Rosalita, and it comes with a poem.
All right.
There comes a time in every season when some gardeners, with good reason, run up against the garden wall and wish to stay inside till fall. It's been too hot, the weeds are bad, the bugs are thick, the flowers sad. Nothing's as it was in June, and thus the annual gardeners swoon. Well, let me suggest one firm solution to create some summer absolution and end that seasonal whine and rant. Consider, please, the spider plant. There's Linda Armstrong and Cherry Queen to liven up the summer scene, with one more fine lady there to greet ya, the seedless, thornless Senorita Rosalita.
Very good.
I got to get that plant.
Yeah, I suspect you are.
Kind of ruined some of the fun, maybe.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Bob. That ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you'll join us next week for some more fun in the garden.
Homegrown is produced by the totally thornless Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.